Hey everyone, thanks for joining me for another podcast. I feel really fortunate today to have Professor Ed McGuire from Arizona State University with me. He's not only an expert in policing, but he's also an instructor in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and owns his own academy. So with what's been happening in the world, I'm really excited to share his perspectives with you guys. We talk about a little bit about him, you know, a working class kid from Massachusetts, his journey through academia and martial arts. We also talk about police use of force training. What's the current state of police use of force training in the United States? We talk a little bit about chokeholds. Should they be being used in police work? We talk about the Rayshard Brooks police homicide down in Atlanta recently and the fallout from that. We also talk about protests and how police should handle protests and a little bit about how aggressive tactics can backfire on police and really how police should be handling protests and what are the most effective ways to handle these crises. And finally, we talk about the future of policing in America. You know, this is a stressful time and it's a period of change. And we talk a little bit about what policing might look like in the future. If you really want to support the program, make sure you subscribe, follow the program, share it as much as possible. I really appreciate that. And then if you also want to follow me on Twitter so you can be aware of new content, please follow me. It's Thomas Owen Baker. And I really appreciate your time. Sit back and enjoy. Hey, thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate the time. I know these are crazy times for everybody, and so I appreciate it. I did a brief introduction ahead of time, and I was just wondering, before we get started, just so people sort of know where you're coming from, can you tell us a little bit about you? So, like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Newburyport, Massachusetts, which is in the northeastern corner of Massachusetts, near the border of New Hampshire and near the ocean. Beautiful seaside community and lovely, lovely place to grow up.
I am familiar. I went to high school in New Hampshire, so I spent some time in Newburyport. Yeah. How did you come to study policing? So you studied policing. What took you? What was your sort of path to this field of study?
I had an uncle. It was actually a great uncle who was a police officer in Newburyport for 26 years, and was kind of a hero of mine, kind of like a grandfather type figure in my life, and just a really, you know, a big burly guy who was just a really kind-hearted, super, you know, fair, friendly, loving guy, you know, one day when I was a kid, my neighbor made the awful mistake of beating up his wife and then tried to take a punch at my uncle when he came to intervene in that situation. And that turned out to be a mistake for my neighbor. And I saw a side of my uncle that I had never seen before, because he was always a big teddy bear. And the next thing you know, he's dragging this guy down the steps of his house. And I was always sort of fascinated by the two sides, you know. They used to call it the iron fist and the velvet glove, you know.
Right.
Really fascinated by just that line of work. And I went to college I was a blue collar kid, first generation college student, and I intended to become a police officer. And the only reason I didn't become a police officer was because at some point in my college career, I had a very influential professor, Larry Siegel. A lot of people know Larry Siegel because he's written a lot of the introductory criminology and criminal justice textbooks. And Larry Siegel was my professor at the University of Lowell at the time, and which is where all the blue collar kids and kids who couldn't afford to go elsewhere went. And at one point, Larry Siegel pulled me aside and said, you know, I really like your work. You know, you're a smart guy. You should get a PhD. And so I asked Larry Siegel, what's a PhD? Know what it was. And Larry had gone to the State University of New York at Albany to their School of Criminal Justice. And boy, he just kind of, he was in my ear, you know, mostly my junior and senior year of college, about going to get a PhD. And so I ended up going to Albany because that's where Larry told me I should go. And the rest is history.
Yeah, I think we have some things in common. I come from a working class background, and even though my mother, when I was a kid, would have said, do anything. You can do anything when you're surrounded by your, you know, like your peers and the people you're around, you start to see like what types of jobs they and things they go into. And I would have thought of, like, being, you know, a professor as something that like the doctor's kid, like there were other kids who did things like that. And that wasn't something I considered a realistic sort of path for me. And that was sort of the same. Was that is that how you like felt? Did you, was it that you thought it was inaccessible or you just didn't even consider it?
It's almost like I didn't even know it existed.
Right.
You just never would have thought of it. I mean, when I was growing up, the performance measure that, you know, for kids in my social class, in my community was, when you grow up, you should get a job that has benefits,
right?
Like health benefits, vacation, paid vacation and things like that. So, you know, for me growing up, that was always my performance measure. I'm going to get a job that has benefits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the bar was pretty low. You know, but, you know, the benefit of all of that, and I was really fortunate, a couple of years ago, the School of Criminal Justice of Albany saw fit to give me a Distinguished Alumni Award, and they let me give their commencement address for the School of Criminal Justice. And so I returned to Albany after 20 plus years and did that. And I invited my dad, who's a career auto mechanic. My dad quit high school in ninth grade. And, you know, they sat him in the front row. And I was really grateful for the opportunity to be able to say, even though I approached this career from kind of a different angle than most people, I was really well prepared for it because my dad was the hardest working human being I had ever known. You know, and going to graduate school with that kind of work ethic, that blue collar work ethic, I mean, I still have it to this day, you know.
Right.
You know, for me, my whole career, I've just outworked most of the people around me. And that turns out to have been a really amazing background to prepare me for this career. And I never knew that was going to happen, but here we are. So.
Yeah. I think it seems like my working class friends and my, you know, friends that are like part of the managerial sort of class, they value very different things. Like working class people, they tend to focus on things like, you know, disciplining yourself to get things done, getting a job with real, you know, benefits and pay, and like it's down to earth. And I can see how that would be an advantage in academia, where so many people spend so much time, including myself, caught up in thinking about themselves and how they feel about things, and they don't get a lot done. I talk about the benefits. I think that was one of the major things that drew me to policing was my grandparents. I grew up sort of with my mother, but also spent a lot of time with my grandparents who grew up during the Depression, and they both fourth grade education, but the hardest working people you'd ever met in your life. And policing to them was, well, you have stability, you're going to have benefits, you're not going to get laid off, no matter how bad things get, you've got this, you know, sort of security. So I think that for me as a working class person, and I think a lot of police officers, the reason they go into the field, a lot of it has to do with this idea of getting a pension, security, decent health care. So I don't think people think about that a lot. Like people think, well, what drives people to become a police officer? I think that's a big part of it. You agree with that or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, it's job security. And I think that's driven generations of police officers to that career.
And people see their uncles and yep, fathers, and they see the stability that comes with, which traditionally there has been some stability. I'm not so sure if that's true anymore. Do you sort of occupy a variety of roles? You're not only do you study policing, but you also are involved in jiu-jitsu. Can you tell us a little bit about your path into, you know, how you discovered jiu-jitsu and sort of where you are in your jiu-jitsu journey?
Yeah, so when I was in college, I went to the university, what's now called the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. Mm-hmm. Back was there, it was called the University of Lowell, but Lowell is a pretty tough community in Massachusetts. Historically, it had a lot of social problems. My understanding is it's been cleaned up a lot over the years since I've been back, but historically was a pretty rough and tumble town. And when I was there, I was always interested in boxing. And so,
It's a big boxing town, right? Long tradition.
Yeah, big boxing town. So when I was there, I wandered over to Art Romalo's West End Gym, pretty famous gym in the boxing community in the Northeast. And I just kind of wandered in there and I met Art. He was a super nice guy, very welcoming. I was a junior, I think, at the time. And I just said, well, I'd like to learn how to box. So Art and some of his instructors taught me how to box. And quite frankly, I wasn't very good at it, at least in the beginning. So that was kind of my introduction to martial arts, really enjoyed that. So when I went to Albany to start working on my PhD, I ended up taking my interest in boxing with me, and I ended up going to a gym in the it was funny because Art Romalo's West End gym was a mixed ethnicity, so you had African-American, white, Hispanic, and even some Asian fighters in there. This is, by the way, where the film The Fighter was. That's where mm-hmm. it came from. That's where Irish Mickey Ward came from, that yep. gym. But anyway, so when I went to Albany, you didn't have that. I mean, you had black boxing gyms. That was it. I grew up in Newburyport, Massachusetts, which is almost entirely a white community. I had very little exposure until I started boxing to African-Americans at all. I just had no, growing up in Newburyport, you just don't have that. Mm-hmm. So Art Romalo's West End gym was sort of mixed race and ethnicity. In Albany, all the boxing gyms, for the most part, are black boxing gyms. And so I ended up being the only white guy in an all black boxing gym in a really depressed area of Albany. I had a fantastic coach named Ray Holland. Ray had been a military boxer, a really, really wonderful man. So I spent another couple of years boxing there, and that was really enjoyable, getting beat up a lot. but really, learning how to box from people who really knew what they were doing. And I just, at some point, had this kind of epiphany after I left Albany that all I know about how to defend myself is to punch somebody. Right. It's like, right. And I don't know, I would like to, know more than just being able to punch somebody. I'm a man of peace. I don't want to have mm-hmm. to hit people to get out of trouble, And so at the time, Hoist Gracie's early fights in the UFC, that really influenced me, seeing Hoist Gracie be able to take down these much larger, much stronger opponents. And he did a lot of it without ever even throwing a strike.
This was like the early 90s is when this
early
was sort 90s. Of
I was sort of fascinated by the fact that this smaller, weaker guy could defeat these larger, stronger opponents, and he never had to do the only thing that I knew, which is to hit people. So that's what I got into to jiu-jitsu. And at the time, my first academic job was in Omaha, Nebraska, and I started studying jiu-jitsu out there. And I ended up leaving jiu-jitsu for a lot of years. I was a single dad, and it was just really difficult to train and stuff like that. And so I ended up coming back to it much later, ended up getting a blue belt from Grandmaster Helson Gracie. His schools at the time I was living in the Washington, D.C. area, and his schools kind of blew up for a while. So I was out of jiu-jitsu for a while. And then I just had the great fortune of Master Pedro Sauer happened to relocate from Utah to the Washington, D.C. area. And the rest is history. I joined up with Master Pedro Sauer's school back when I was a blue belt, and have been with him ever since. Trained at his headquarters. He's got about 120 schools worldwide, and I was at the headquarters. And so got to see all the people who came from all over the world on a weekly basis to come train with him and learn from him, and forge connections with martial artists from all over the planet, and really amazing experience being able to train with somebody as like the combination of humility and skill mm-hmm. in Master Pedro Sauer is for me unprecedented, and I wouldn't want to have anybody else to look up to as a jiu-jitsu mentor.
Yeah, it's you talk about that epiphany that you had where you said, wow, like you saw Hoist in those early days controlling these much larger men and how it was done with skill. Mine was in the Army in Washington State, and I had just arrived at my unit, And I was, you know, 18 years old, and I was big and strong football player. And I thought I can mash anybody. And we had this in my unit, we had a thing, it was called the combatives pit. And it was like a little area with like wood chips. And once a week we would go in there and do combatives, and the Gracies would come out and train back in the early 90s. Okay. It was one of the Ranger battalions, and they had a relationship with the battalion. So they would train some guys, and then those guys would train the rest of the soldiers. It was very rudimentary. It was like, you know, guard and, you know, just very basic stuff, but very useful. And this, you could call anybody out during the grappling. So rank didn't matter, kind of a thing. And this corporal looked at me and said, "Get over here, Baker." And he was my boss. And I thought, finally, I'm going to grind this man into the, and he's been riding me and treating me like garbage since I got here. And I'm going to put the hurt on him. And he was like a little chimpanzee. When I got my hands on him, he just immediately took my back, was toying with me, and like there was nothing I could do. And it was like an epiphany. I was like, wow, there's something you can learn, that size still matters. But it was like a shock. It was a real shock to me. So that was kind of my moment where I realized that it was different. Did you have, what was it like for you when you first started training? Did you take to it right away, or was it frustrating? Was it like for me, if I take a break and I go back, there's a panic that I feel that I have to learn to deal with. What was it like for you beginning to immerse yourself in the sport?
Well, I mean, it's humbling because you know, there's the psychologist at Harvard who came up with the theory of multiple intelligences, and I've read the theory and read some of the work on it, and there's nothing in my life like jiu-jitsu that convinces me of the validity of that theory. He has that one branch of intelligence. I think he calls it kinesthetic or kinesiological or something like that, but it's the movement of your body through space and time. Mm-hmm. And I realized that in most areas of my life, I'm a pretty smart guy. And in that branch of intelligence, I'm a pretty dumb guy. Like, and so I watched over the years, you know, instructor would teach a move, you know, show it for 1 minute or 2 minutes, and then we'd all go drill it. And what I would see is all the people around me would be able to do the move right away. I couldn't do it. I have to see that damn move 100 times before I get it. And I just realized, you know, there's just something about the way my brain functions that I can't watch a body in motion do a set of maneuvers and then immediately replicate those maneuvers. I don't know what it is about my brain chemistry or my wiring that doesn't allow for that. But I'm a slow learner, and I think it's really influenced my teaching as a jiu-jitsu instructor. I teach to myself, essentially, which is to the lowest common denominator. I teach to the person who really isn't gifted and doesn't just immediately get it.
I found that the smaller, like the people who have to really rely on learning the techniques and can't rely on athleticism or that, and that type of intelligence of just seeing and doing, and smaller people in jiu-jitsu, I don't know if you feel this way, but they tend to develop a better technique over time because they need to rely. You've noticed that as well?
Yeah, and I mean, Master Sauer used to joke about this. Going back to the very beginning, I mean, Master Sauer used to say to us, he'd say, you know, yeah, you can beat up that little guy right now, but trust me when I tell you, a couple of years down the road, if he or she keeps coming, my friend, you're in for a world of hurt, so be nice now. Yeah, I mean, the smaller people in jiu-jitsu, their pathway is more difficult. They get smashed on the way up, you know, they end up with larger, heavier people on top of them and grinding on them and all of that kind of thing. But what happens because they go through that experience and they're not able to respond with muscle and strength and all of these sort of dysfunctional ways of responding, they end up developing better technique. And so beware the smaller technical person. And that's what Master Sauer is. He's a smaller, more technical guy. I had him to my school last year. He came to visit. and meet my students and so forth. And I mean, that was the one reaction everybody had was, he's so little. Mm-hmm. Like, how is one of the world's most, you know, one of the world's toughest men so little and so skinny? They were really shocked by that. And especially, you know, he had a challenge fight back in Utah many years ago with Mr. Utah bodybuilder, who was just a giant guy, looked like the Incredible Hulk. And but Master Sauer was able to beat him fairly easily. And so a lot of my students had seen that video. But when that video was shot, you know, he was a little younger and, you know, he was never a big guy, but he was certainly bigger than he is now. Now he's in his 60s. And so when my students saw, you know, here's this guy, he's just really, really, you know, a smaller, skinnier guy, I think it really locked in for them how powerful what we do is. Right. That you could look like that and still really, really be a very tough human being. I think that was useful for them to see, just see him in person.
Right.
Understand that, wow, I can do this. It doesn't matter that I weigh 120 pounds. I'm going to be fine. I just have to stick to the knitting, learn jiu-jitsu by the book, and I'm going to be okay.
And that, and you said the challenges, just so people, if they're not familiar, this was when jiu-jitsu was sort of emerging as a martial art in the United States. Around the world, this was what happened, where practitioners would invite other martial artists and strong people from around the community. If you want to come in and disprove this and show that you can beat our techniques, and then they would sometimes put out the smaller, less advanced students to, and as a way to demonstrate to potential students, am I on the right track here?
Yeah. So we have it easy as jiu-jitsu practitioners today, because we've mostly, you know, our predecessors have gone through the hurt of proving this martial art to the world. But, you know, when the Brazilians first came to the United States, you know, they had to prove themselves, and a lot of people would call them out and challenge them. And actually, when Mr. Utah challenged Pedro Sauer, Pedro lived in Utah. He barely spoke English at the time. He was still learning how to speak English. You know, he spoke Portuguese. And so somebody had put, said on the radio, had challenged him. And so one of his students said, you know, oh, Professor Sauer, there's a man on the radio challenging you to a fight. And so Professor said, okay, I'll fight him. He never saw him. And so I imagine it was a little bit of a surprise when he saw him for the first time. I mean, this was a huge guy, 250-pound bodybuilder, Mr. Utah. And, you know, Pedro was probably more than 100 pounds less than him. But in his mindset as a Brazilian jiu-jitsu fighter and as a direct descendant of the founder of the art, Elio Gracie, Grandmaster Elio Gracie, in his mind, it would not even have occurred to him to not accept a challenge. For him, it's just, you know, Grandmaster Elio taught him this martial art, and you have to defend the martial art. So if somebody's challenging it, you accept the challenge. And it was not a violent thing, and, you know, it was not, you're not trying to hurt anybody or anything like that. You're just trying to demonstrate the benefits of this martial art. You're trying to demonstrate that it really does work. And so they accepted all comers.
And you, and I've watched a bunch of the old footage, and you'll see the Gracie guys, just like anyone, people get upset, and they could be, sometimes there would be flashbacks, but you would see the Gracie guy gain a dominant position, then use like open hand strikes, or just threaten the person and give them opportunities to just submit, because it wasn't about humiliating or hurting person. It was about them as being a future student, of saying, look, you've been on a different path. Consider this path, and as a demonstration of the community. So it was definitely not a malicious sort of thing.
No, and after Pedro beat Mr. Utah, Mr. Utah came and studied at his academy for a while. And that was always, you know, he always kind of aimed for that, you know, I'm gonna defeat this person. I'm not gonna let them beat me up. I will defeat them, typically by submission, not with strikes, where the person can tap out and say, okay, I give up, I say uncle. And then afterwards, be super nice to them, super kind to them, and invite them to come train at your academy with you. And many times they would do that. And I think that's a beautiful part of our art.
So Mr. Utah had his combatives pit moment, like I did, but a little harsher, maybe.
Exactly.
So you have expertise in policing. You have expertise in jiu-jitsu. Over an extended period of time, you've watched both of these sort of cultures evolve and change and grow. And as a person who understands violence and as a person who understands policing, can you maybe, because I think people, when they think of a police officer, if you're not familiar with policing, I know before I was a police officer, I thought, oh, police officers, they know how to shoot and fight and, you know, use violence in an expert way. They're the people who are trained to do that. That's their job. Can you tell us a little bit about what does a police officer, and I know there's a lot of variability, there's, you know, 18,000 different departments, but if you randomly selected a handful of cops from around the country, can you just tell the listener maybe what would you expect that person to have in terms of training when it comes to the use of unarmed combat, like how to defend themselves or use violence to control a suspect?
Yeah, so, you know, there is no centralized system of training police officers on defensive tactics. And so you end up with this sort of crazy potpourri of training, some of which is ridiculous and some of which is good and everything in between. And, you know, but overall, I think the problem is there's just not much of the training, you know, so even when you do have training that has appropriate content, like valid types of techniques being taught, there's just not a lot of it. And so we end up seeing, it hurts my heart as somebody who studies policing and as somebody who studies martial arts to watch these videos of encounters between police officers and the public, where, you know, when things go hands-on, you just often see police just quite frankly, just not knowing what to do. I mean, I think that's the bottom line. We had an officer-involved shooting that resulted in the death of a member of the public here back in, I think, November or December. You know, in the fight between the officer and the suspect, the officer ended up falling on his back, didn't just know what to do from his back. And so ended up having to shoot the suspect. And it was a valid shooting. I'm not questioning in any way the legality of the shooting. I mean, it was a valid shooting. The only thing I would say is it was a shooting that could have been avoided literally with, like, you know, I taught a student, our school just reopened after the coronavirus, well, not after, we're still in the middle of it, but our school just reopened, our jiu-jitsu school, just last week. And I had a brand new student, first day student. And on the first day of this student's class, I taught, what do you do if you're on your back and you have a standing opponent who's trying to, you know, hit you, kick you, jump on you, right? Just how do you position your body and how do you keep that person away from you so they can't hurt you? Literally the very first day of jiu-jitsu training, that's what I'm teaching this student, because it's such a common scenario to have a person, you know, you're on your back and you have an aggressor coming at you. This police officer, I really truly believe if this police officer had had a week of jiu-jitsu training on, and I don't mean a week of 40 hours, I mean a week three one-hour classes, mm-hmm. just what to do from the back when you have somebody aggressing toward you, I don't think there would have been a shooting. And again, I'm not criticizing the officer, because the officer just simply didn't have that training, right? Agencies and even states are not providing the types of training that would actually, and I think people get a little confused by this. They think, well, if they're studying jiu-jitsu, they're going to hurt people. Most of the situations where I see jiu-jitsu as being successfully applied in policing would result in a suspect sustaining less damage or perhaps even no damage, not more. This is just how to teach police officers the basics of what to do with their bodies, where to position themselves to be able to control a suspect without having to use violence.
And I would agree. I mean, I've watched, for the project I've been working on, I've gone through, like, read thousands of accounts of officer involved police related deaths, and I'll watch video. So if there's a newspaper report, I'll read that. But if there's a video, I'll watch that as well. So I've watched just tons of these deadly force encounters. It's kind of morbid work, but, I see it over and over again where I watch something take place and I it's immediately apparent to me that the police officer has no idea how to react, that they're in fear, and that when I was a police officer and I was encountering a situation where I was terrified, which a few times I was, and I could see my body reacting in ways that I had trained it to react. So like I was in a deadly force encounter with a firearm and I had to shoot somebody. It wasn't as though I right there decided how to shoot. It was my body reacting to the dangerous situation with what I had plugged into the brain. And the same thing when I was in a fist fight or something like that, I was scared, but I was also like, okay, well, this guy's stupid. Like I was able to think, you know, I was able to think rationally. I was like, okay, I need to get a dom. I'm going to get a dominant position where his hands, you know, I can use my knee to pin his arm there. I can get on the radio, you know, like I was able to think. But if you don't have those skills and they're not reinforced on a regular basis, my opinion, when something traumatic happens, you're just going to do whatever you can do to survive. And if you don't know anything, then one thing you have been taught to do is shoot. It really bothers me when I see something where I think just a few days in a room with someone like you could have taught them the basic skills to get by. Now you say that this is something that's very minimal training could improve things, and I agree. But if you were dictator perpetua of America and in charge of policing, what do you think citizens should as a citizen yourself, what would think in your mind the type of performance that you would expect from police officers and their ability to use force? How much type of training, like per week, per month, do you think would be a reasonable amount of training to train police officers with the basic jiu-jitsu skills required to reduce the level of force that's being used on the street, if that makes sense?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we can, jiu-jitsu is vast, right? There are a lot of different aspects of jiu-jitsu and jiu-jitsu has I come from a particular lineage of jiu-jitsu. Grandmaster Elio Gracie, his son Hickson Gracie, and their student Pedro Sauer. So that's my lineage. So I come from a lineage that has a very particular viewpoint about how jiu-jitsu ought to be taught and what it should involve. It's not the only lineage, it's not the only viewpoint. And so much of jiu-jitsu has taken on a very sport-like orientation, you know, and so it's gotten really kind of very sophisticated, very fancy, and very sport-focused, athletic-focused, competition-focused. And I have no concern whatsoever with any of that. I think it's all beautiful, and I'm glad to see the art evolving in those ways. But most of that aspect of the art, which is really starting to take over jiu-jitsu in the United States anyway, most of that is not helpful for law enforcement. The old school Elio Gracie, Hickson Gracie lineage, Helson Gracie lineage, of jiu-jitsu, which is just basic self-defense, right? So if we strip the martial art of all its fanciness and we just focus on really basic self-defense techniques, and I think those are the things that can help police officers the most. And so, you know, if we could get police officers to the point where they're spending an hour a week, you know, doing something like that, like maybe some initial course that's a stripped down version of just the most essential elements of jiu-jitsu, stripping away all that stuff that'll help you win competitions and look fancy in a YouTube video, and just really focus on, you know, how do we preserve your life? How do we stop? I joke around when I teach the kids, I say, when you come here and you study jiu-jitsu with me, I call it my getting punched in the face prevention plan. Right? So how do we just boil jiu-jitsu down into how are you going to not get punched in the face? How are you not going to get, you know, injured or killed in the line of duty? And we just strip jiu-jitsu down to those basic elements. That's where I think we can make it. And you know, look, Henner and Huron Gracie in Torrance, California have done this. I think, I don't remember the number, but they've got it down to what, 30 or 32 moves or something like that.
Yeah. I went and did their GSA, the Academy down in Louisville, yeah, and saw them training the officers. It's really interesting. I think they've done a good job of boiling, yeah, it down to something that can be, you can teach people, have them reinforce it, and then have them share and reinforce it as well.
Yeah. So, you know, if we strip it down to the basic elements and we don't make it like you're trying to become a black belt or you're trying to become a world champion, this is just, you know, here's a subset of the techniques from the art that will help save your life. And more importantly, not more importantly than help save your life, but more commonly help you control another, a resisting subject, right? That's what it really almost always boils down to is, you know, you're trying to arrest somebody and the person is trying to run away or trying to hurt you or whatever. How do you control that body? How do you control that human being? And preferably without injuring them, without harming them, and without sustaining any damage to yourself. You know, those techniques, it doesn't take a lot of time. I mean, you could study jiu-jitsu for, you know, a very short amount of time and have those basics. You have to have some level of refresher because it's all going to disappear if you don't. But it really doesn't, I think, take a lot. You know, you don't have to become a master of the art or anything like that. And we know, and you talked about this, we know that in times of stress, times of fear, you know, these micro body mechanics, they don't work very well. No. I always think about when I proposed to my wife. I was, my son at the time was studying magic, you know, magic tricks, illusions. And so I was just at the time kind of goofing around with magic tricks. And so I decided I'm going to propose to my wife. I'm going to do a little magic trick. I'm going to kind of make a ring appear out of nowhere. Well, here's what it looked like. My hands were shaking so bad because I was under stress to propose to my wife that I literally fumbled and bumbled the magic trick. I managed, yeah, to get the proposal out, you know, the verbal part, but the magic trick fell apart. If I am so nervous and shaking trying to propose to my wife, nobody's trying to shoot me. Nobody's trying to punch me or kick me, right? And so it's really a lesson in we can't depend on these sort of, you know, these very fancy kinds of techniques that require very fancy kinds of specific, you know, motor movements. We need to rely on gross motor movements, just large body movements, right? And so absolutely, we can jiu-jitsu down into those so that, and train them enough so that they're in your muscle memory, and you're able to deploy them almost kind of automatically, like you talked about in the situations where you were under distress. That's, I think, what we need to do for police.
And if you, well, so you're not only you study policing, you study jiu-jitsu, but you're also a romantic as well, which is nice. That was a sweet story. You're not talking about turning everyone into a black belt. You're talking about some initial training with basic moves that have been proven over time to be very effective. And then a regular sort of reinforcing those skills. Like I think if it was an hour a week that police officers around the country spent on the mat before a shift, I think that would have a major improvement in their skill set. What about, can you see that trickling? Because I know for me, like I'm terrible with my jiu-jitsu. I go and I train for a period of time and then it gets difficult and I don't. And then it's like I'm reintroducing myself over and over again. But when I'm engaged in the activity, I find that it's a stress reliever. I'm in better shape. I think better. I don't know if this is something that's universal, but there is a lot of evidence to suggest that physical fitness and exercise has tons of positive effects. And we know that in policing, we have an obesity problem, we have heart disease problem, we have a suicide problem, mental health problems, drinking problems, drug abuse problems, prescription pills, mostly. Can you see something like this having not just an effect on use of force, but other effects on policing?
Yeah, so the physical health and wellness effects are amazing. You know, I'm going a little stir crazy because we closed for 3 months during the pandemic, and And this is my stress relief. This is my source of physical fitness. So I'm kind of losing my mind a little bit. And I know my students are feeling the same way. I'm getting messages from my students. I'm like, I can't take it, man. I need to get back to jiu-jitsu. People get kind of addicted to it. But the other aspect of it that I think is important, and I really didn't, I knew about this for myself, but I really didn't know about this until I became an instructor, which was about two and a half years ago. And that is the mental health benefits. And so I've had some students with depression issues, and they report that jiu-jitsu helps them address their depression issues. I've had students with post-traumatic stress disorder, including from policing, who report that when they train, the nightmares that they've been having tend to decrease. You know, this is anecdotal, I'm a researcher, so I don't peddle too much in anecdotes, and I'm not familiar with a body of research evidence on the physical and mental health benefits of jiu-jitsu yet. But you know, from my own students, it's rewarding to hear that they're experiencing these benefits, and I wonder about the extent to which, if police officers were to engage more in this type of training, if they could have this kind of wide spectrum of benefits, something to be studied, maybe by you.
And I've got enough things I'm behind on. I don't need another one. I think, and again, this is we're talking about anecdote, but I think lived experience is important. Especially if we don't have access to research on it yet, this can inform, you know, like the questions we ask. There's this a feeling that I have when I do jiu-jitsu of, I don't know what the term that people use, but it's being, I guess, present, where you're not thinking about. So when I'm on the mat, I'm not thinking about my job. I'm not thinking about my problems, the things that I did wrong, blah, blah, blah. I'm thinking about not getting choked. I'm thinking about doing what I need to do and manipulating my body through time and space to keep this 160-pound person who's 100 pounds less than me from choking me and making me tap. So I think that might be part of it, is just that if giving officers a space where they can disconnect from everything and making it part of their daily duties. I can't see a negative. Maybe there are more injuries, the cost, but yeah. I think that they would outweigh the positive. So we've talked quite a bit about some of the positives of violence, really. So learning how to utilize violence with skill can be a way that you can reduce violence. I think that's a fair statement to make. Like these shootings where I see if this officer had been able to control this person, like it's too soon to make any, but when you see the person in it who got killed in Atlanta recently, if the officer had been able to control that person on the ground and gain a dominant position, and as they're trying to build up and get back to the ground, if they've broken down, broken them down and worked together and they've been better trained.
Well, let me weigh in on that incident in particular. I have a very unpopular thing to say about that incident. There is a national movement right now to ban chokeholds. And I'm not going to criticize the movement in any way, but I just want to weigh in on it. Well, first of all, as you know, as a jiu-jitsu guy, you know, there's not a chokehold. There's multiple kinds of things that we might call a chokehold, right? So a lot of the people who are talking about banning chokeholds don't actually know what chokeholds are. They just sound bad. They sound violent, so let's ban them. Let me make a suggestion to you. There was a moment in that exchange where the officers were fighting, okay, where one of the officers had his back. And so we talk about wanting to ban a chokehold, okay? Certain types of chokeholds are actually very gentle, very peaceful, and applied by somebody who knows how to do them properly are not violent. They're very gentle. And so at that point in the encounter, when one of the officers had the back of the suspect, all he had to do was slip in a rear naked choke, a vascular neck restraint, as the police officers call it, and that encounter would have been over right there. That suspect would not have been injured. That shooting never would have happened, okay? And so it's a controversial point of view. A lot of people will disagree with me on this, but a well-deployed vascular neck restraint by somebody who knows how to do it properly, who's well-trained, maybe certified, if we could develop certification procedures, would have ended that encounter right there with no damage, no violence, no shooting, no looting, no riots, no anything. And so it's a tough position to take right now. I know a lot of people will not want to hear that, but it's just an example of where a proper ability to be able to control somebody else's movements gently and without injuring them can prevent a lot of violence.
And that was the next thing I was gonna ask you about, because we do have this move to you know, eliminate chokehold. We call it a choke. So, but really it's a form of strangulation. So you're blocking blood to and fro or both at the same time. We don't really know, I don't think, fully understand why people lose consciousness. I think we're not quite sure how it all works, but can you maybe just, what's the difference from your understanding, what's the difference between choking someone and what we call a rear naked choke or a neck restraint?
So when we wrap an arm around somebody's neck, the devil is in the details of exactly where our arm goes around their neck and where the pressure is applied. If we use the bone in our forearm, almost like imagine the bone in our forearm being like a broomstick, we wrap around somebody's neck and we pull on their trachea. We can crush the trachea. We can injure the person. We could kill the person. And so somebody who, you know, maybe has seen in a UFC or an MMA competition, what we call in jiu-jitsu, a rear naked choke, if they don't know what they're doing, they'll often do that. So when I have students tell me, professor, I know the rear naked choke. I say, okay, show me. And they come in and they do exactly the wrong thing, right? They take their forearm, the bone of their forearm, and they squish my trachea. Now, fortunately, I have the benefit in that environment of being able to tap out. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so I can relieve that pressure immediately. But if you do that kind of pressure on a suspect in a fight, if you're a police officer, you can kill, the person isn't gonna tap out, you can kill them, you can injure them severely, crush the trachea. So that's a very dangerous move and that has no place in policing. There are many people, who have succumbed to those kinds of injuries over time by officers who are either improperly trained or who just didn't know what they were doing. But a really well-placed rear naked choke or vascular neck restraint doesn't involve any pressure at all on the trachea. The pressure comes into the side of the neck on the carotid arteries. And actually one of the instructors at my academy taught me this. I had never heard it put like this before, but what he teaches is when he's teaching what we call the rear naked choke, what he teaches is if your training partner has to cough or clear their throat, you did it wrong. Uh-huh. Never heard that before coming up in jiu-jitsu, but it's a beautiful point.
It's a good point.
Because, and you often see students when they're training this, they're coughing or clearing their throat. The reason they're doing that is because some pressure was placed on their trachea. And so when we do it right, there's actually like a little hollow in front of your trachea because you have the elbow, you have the neck and mm-hmm. elbow joint there. And so there is no pressure on the trachea. The pressure comes in this direction, which is why, so you'll hear some people refer to it as a lateral carotid restraint. The pressure is lateral. It's not coming this way, it's coming this way. And when it's applied properly by somebody who knows how to administer it, and more importantly, knows when to let go, then it's a very gentle move. And it ends the fight right there because the person will pass out and that's the end of it. And so the debate right now, unfortunately, is taking both of those moves and placing them under one label, the chokehold, and seeking to ban all of it. And I understand that, certainly understand it. But I do hope at some point we can have a more refined conversation about exactly what it is we're proposing to ban, because I do think this move could help prevent violence in police-citizen encounters, rather than increasing it.
Absolutely. And that the being able to talk people when they're in that position, they can still talk, they can breathe. It doesn't, if it's executed properly, it doesn't obstruct the airway. It's just the blood. So like I had an experience where I was in a fight with a guy. He had run and we tackled him and we're scrambling on the ground, and I ended up gaining his back and get my hooks in. So my legs are wrapped around his waist and he was like moving to his waistband. And it turns out he had drugs in his underwear and he was trying to get rid of the drugs. But in my mind, he may have been going for a weapon, and I was concerned about that. And I was able to trap his right arm with my leg, with my hooks. And I threw in a rear naked choke and applied just a little bit of pressure. And his hands, I could feel them come from his waistband. And he was saying, but I wasn't applying it to put him unconscious. I was using it as a control technique and then to give him a window to comply. So I gave him instructions and he said something like, "You can't choke me." And I said, "Well, I'm about to choke you to sleep if you don't stop resisting." And he, you know, he complied because he realized, okay, this guy's gonna. So the other option was to not do it and to punch him in the face, or I had a flashlight in my hand. Someone's going for their waistband in the middle of the night in an alley, and after I chase them from a stolen vehicle, they're gonna get cracked upside the head with a flashlight. You know, like it's. So I think people need to think, if we remove a force option from police, that is not going to all of a sudden be a vacuum where no force is applied. That vacuum right. is going to be filled by some other force option. And that may very well be, like we saw in Atlanta. I think you make an excellent point. Would we rather Mr. Brooks have been put out and handcuffed, or would we rather him have been shot? So I appreciate you making that point. Another question. I'm sorry, I'm taking up a lot of your time. If you need to split, just give me a wave here. I've also heard you talk about that's an instance where violence could be productive. Can you talk a little bit about, I had a friend of mine who I was in the Army with the other day on Facebook say, 2nd Ranger Battalion is just down the road from Chaz. Let's just send them up there and they'll clear that up in a few hours. Or, you know, I have other friends saying, you know, we'll just need to go crackheads and end this kind of when they see these protests. Can you talk a little bit about how a protest can be transformed into something more when the state utilizes violence as a control mechanism? Is that something that you're concerned about?
Yeah. You know, one of the things I've never had a chance to talk about this publicly before, so the only person, only people who have ever heard this are my students at the academy. But you know, one of the things Master Sauer talks a lot about, he jokes, he says, you know where I use jiu-jitsu the most, and he's referring to the mindset, not the physical moves. He said, you know where I use jiu-jitsu the most? With my wife. He said, you know, I'm not going to fight with my wife. You know, I'm going to de-escalate. You know, this kind of thing. But you know, coming from that lineage, there's a mindset of he calls jiu-jitsu problem solving under duress. And what he says is the greatest benefit of jiu-jitsu is when you're under a really stressful situations, still being able to keep a calm head and just think about how do I solve this problem? And so he views every part of jiu-jitsu as a problem to be solved. You know, there's a man on top of me, he's trying to choke me or he's trying to armbar me. This is a problem to be solved. So I'm not gonna freak out and just, you know, blast off. I'm gonna chill out. I'm gonna do the opposite. I'm gonna calm down, slow down my thinking, and make a really rational decision about how to solve this problem that I'm facing. And boy, what a beautiful mindset to think about applying to every aspect of policing, to just slow down your thinking, calm down, make a rational decision about how to solve a problem, right? And what we often see, both in one-on-one encounters and in crowd police encounters with crowds, is we often see very emotional decisions that are based in fear or anger or frustration and these kinds of things. And so about 8 years ago, quite by accident, I might add, I ended up studying the police response to Occupy Wall Street. And the reason I started to do that was because I had a group of PhD students at the time at American University who I would refer to them as kind of, they were like a social justice-y type of, I just happened to have every PhD cohort has a different kind of personality. That was my social justice year. You know, they were kind of, in a previous generation, they would have been called hippies. And great, great students, really cared deeply about the world. And what they were seeing on TV with regard to how police in multiple cities were responding to Occupy Wall Street was sort of shocking to their collective conscience. And so I had a class with them that had nothing to do with Occupy Wall Street, but every week, no matter what we were studying, the conversation kept coming back to Occupy Wall Street. And it was a small class. I think we just had 5 or 6 students in it. So one day I finally just, I laughed and I said, boy, we just keep talking about this every week. I said, you know, you folks really seem to be interested in this topic. We have an Occupy Wall Street camp right down the road in Washington, D.C. Let's just go check it out and go talk to some of these folks. And so we kind of on the fly just turned it into an action research project. And so that sort of humble beginning turned into, as my wife would say, protest policing has taken over our lives, because nobody really does it in the United States from the perspective of, let me back up. And so most of the people who study protest policing in the United States are themselves protesters. When I was at the Occupy Wall Street protests in New York City, New York Times journalist interviewed me, and I didn't realize this at the time until the story came out, but I was the only, she was writing about professors who are studying the Occupy movement, and I was the only one who wasn't in the Occupy movement. I hadn't realized that. And so I study the police, but I also work very closely with the police. I have good relationships with the police. And so there aren't many people, if any, in the United States who study the police response to protests who actually work with the police. A lot of times the people who study the response to protests are kind of like throwing stones at the police from the outside, but they're not involved in active partnerships with the police seeking to reform these issues from the inside. Right. And so that gave me kind of a particular vantage point that is common in Europe. There's a lot of people like me in Europe, but not so many in the United States. And so I've been doing a lot of work over the past 8 years, just studying police response to protests from both sides, from the police perspective and from the protester perspective. And what I've found is I've never picked a research topic in which more people are suspicious of me than this topic. So the cops think I'm aligned with the protesters. The protesters think I'm aligned with the cops. And what I'm trying to do, and often unsuccessfully, I might add, is walk this tiny little thin balance beam in between, where I'm just looking for good solutions to this problem to be solved that would benefit both sides. And it's really, really hard to win the trust of both communities, because in some cities, the relationships between the social justice and protest type communities and the police is just awful. I mean, there's just so much mistrust and anger and hostility that it's really, really difficult to try to be the person who bridges that gap. And so please, let's not send in the military in Seattle. Let's rely, you know, and I can benefit here from both a jiu-jitsu approach and from a research approach. You know, we've got 50 years of research that says if we handle those things with a de-escalation mindset and with a gentle manner, we can resolve them. And the jiu-jitsu mentality is, look, this is a problem to be solved, and let's solve it in a manner that doesn't create new problems, you know? And so this is, I think, you know, a big part of my own career future will be working with police agencies to help them adopt evidence-based solutions for resolving their encounters with crowds. It's a big part of policing. It needs a lot of help.
I couldn't agree more. I saw one of the things I saw that was encouraging in the Chaz. I saw some video. It was an administrator from the fire department, and he was walking through the neighborhood, and someone was asking questions. He's like, yeah, they are fine having me here. I have a good relationship with these folks, and I'm just here to see what they need. You know, like he was trying to say, look, you guys are pissed. I just want to help make sure you're safe. Is it okay if I come in here and talk with you guys? And slowly building up trust and building a relationship. I thought that was like a really effective way of addressing it and starting out. We have this incident I'm expecting in Tulsa this weekend. So we have Juneteenth. For people who aren't familiar, it's celebrating the emancipation, or I think it's becoming aware of the emancipation more than the actual emancipation date. And in Tulsa, we're coming up, I think next year will be 100 years since police and citizens and with the cooperation of the government, like murdered a bunch of Black people and bombed a community. And now we have this rally taking place, and we have basically a curfew being put in place, and the president saying there's going to be this heavy-handed response. If again, you're dictator perpetua of America, what do you think, how should this weekend be managed by the state, in your opinion?
Just as gently as possible. And so, you know, we put out a guidebook on the police response to protests and mass demonstrations. It was just published in January by the Harry Frank Guggenheim Foundation. And when we put it out, even though most of the books I publish, I publish them through commercial presses, so you have to buy them. And we don't make any money, by the way, just to make that perfectly clear to anybody who doesn't know that. But I purposely had this guidebook for police on handling protests published through the Guggenheim Foundation. Thank you to them for doing this, because I wanted it to be free. I just wanted it to be freely available to the world. And so they have it on their website. It can be downloaded. But in that book, we present a very, very detailed framework for how to respond to these types of events. It involves a lot of different issues, a lot of communication, a lot of negotiation, a lot of de-escalation. And, you know, if there is violence or property damage or, you know, unlawful behavior going on as part of these responses, then you know, we have a framework, a very detailed framework through which police can gear up. And, you know, there's training that would need to be done to be able to follow some of this. But, you know, you're starting with soft uniforms, lots of communication, lots of negotiation. And as violence starts to increase, just a whole framework for how to gear up, protect officer health and wellness and safety. Just how to de-escalate things. A lot of times in these types of events, the police response tends to escalate the crowd response, and it's a dynamic. And anybody who's ever been married, you can use your marriage as a metaphor, right? You know, it's almost never one direction. You know, it's almost never you're a helpless victim and your spouse is responsible for all the escalation. It's a tit for tat thing. You both go back and forth and you escalate. These things become so much more complex in a crowd setting. And unfortunately, you know, you could have a crowd of 1,000 people and you could have 100 police officers, and all of the escalation could come from 3 crowd members and 1 police officer doing the wrong thing. And this is where social psychology comes into it. You know, you are seen as a police officer, as a representative, like let's say as one police officer behaving poorly, the crowd's going to see that one police officer is representing the other 99, right? Let's say there are 3 crowd members behaving poorly. The police are going to see that those 3 people as representative of the whole crowd. So both sides are actually escalating in response to a very small minority of people on the other side. Okay. And so these become really, really touchy situations. It's virtually never the point or never the case that, you know, the crowd is always wrong and the police are always right, or the police are always wrong and the crowd is always right. There's always this tit for tat escalation that happens. And I think police need to know that, need to own it, and need to plan for it. They need to build in processes that really truly understand how crowd violence and crowd sort of destructive behavior among crowds tends to escalate, and to be able to just prevent that. Police need to approach all of their crowd type situations from a point of view of preventing violence, not escalating it. And you know, we've done a lot of interviews with protesters, including some with these most recent protests. I was just interviewing a young man from Denver last week who said he was attending his first protest. He was just standing there. There was not an order to disperse. And the next thing you know, he was, you know, breathing tear gas and having projectiles fired at him. And the police were backing him and the others into an active intersection that had going through it. And they were deploying these less lethal munitions in a way that they were hitting vehicles in the intersection and endangering public safety. And he said, you know, he goes, you know, there was no looting and no fire setting until the police did that. And then everybody was really pissed off. And then right after all of that, of course, the federal judge in Denver issued a temporary restraining order against the police for how they handled those situations. And so we're seeing those types of things happen a lot. It's interesting to read the temporary restraining orders because the federal judges in these different cities in Dallas, Seattle, Denver, Portland, those are the ones I've read so far. They're all saying the same thing. They're all ordering the police to stop sort of using these munitions arbitrarily or preventively, right? Like there have to be certain conditions under which you can use those tools, and those conditions are not being met, unfortunately.
And I think you make a good point about it, just that in these crowds, it can be just a handful of people that feel a certain way, and then it evokes something. During the Occupy movement, I was in law enforcement, and I was in worked for Phoenix PD at the time, and was working protest lines. You know, so I would go out and work these events. I was on the tactical response unit, so I get called from my job and have to go out and stand in the heat and control these crowds. I remember I was working, you know, robbery cases at the time, and getting pulled off of that to go stand out there, and people are calling you a pig and F you and calling you names, and some people are, you know, throwing things at the police, and you police officers are human beings. So yeah. you get pissed off, and if there's a window to tear gas some MFer that's been calling you names and throwing things at you, as an administrator, as a political figure, as someone in a position of power, it's important that we recognize that once we put armed men and women into a position where human frailty can lead to violence, that we don't know, it can become very unpredictable. Absolutely. Sort of events. And it doesn't just go the way we might expect. It's also risky. Like I think of myself as a military veteran. So I was in the Army, got out, I was a police officer. I left policing very much as a result of my experiences during those protests. So being on those lines, dealing with America's social problems, and then being in these very dynamic political settings evoked a political change in me that led me out of policing. And when you look back in other periods of in other societies, when you use the military police to put down civil unrest, it can backfire in a number of ways. And one of those ways is you may lose, I don't think you're going to lose the police in this environment, but when we're using these human beings, we don't know how this is going to, we don't know the long-term implications, how this is going to affect our culture. I'm really worried about what's been happening. I've kept you here a long time. I just want to turn it over to you one more time and leave you with a space to maybe talk about where we are right now and what sort of, like, for people who don't know a lot about policing, they don't know a lot about police use of force. Can you tell them sort of what your thoughts are right now and what you would maybe like to see happen, what your concerns are? I don't know, just your final thoughts on this topic.
Yeah, I mean, I think right now we have, the Black Lives Matter movement is, I view there as being sort of, you know, something akin to a stock market correction here, where, you know, we have a sense of collective trauma in the African American community and in other minority communities in the United States right now, where there is evidence that these communities are treated disproportionately. And the evidence, by the way, is overwhelming, right? I mean, the evidence is absolutely overwhelming that race and ethnicity matter in dealing with the police. All else held constant, African Americans are absolutely arrested, searched, and stopped at higher rates than other races, you know, and so there are, and that evidence also exists at other points in the criminal justice process, in the court process, and sentencing, and imprisonment, and jail terms, and all of these kinds of things. We see massive evidence of disparities that are due to race and ethnicity, and so the research evidence on this is not unclear. The folks who are protesting based on a collective feeling that they're being treated unfairly. And that's not to say that they're, you know, that in every instance they're treated unfairly, but the research evidence on this is really clear. There are disparities in the criminal justice process at every point in the process, and those need to be addressed. And so these protests are raising valid points. I empathize with what the protesters are experiencing and the collective trauma that they're feeling, the very real pain that they're experiencing. And my only caution as a researcher who studies the police would be, in our zeal to make reforms, let's make sure we make the right reforms. I know that the defund the police movement has a lot of different strands, all the way from outright abolition of police to redirecting funding for police to other portions of the community, other types of helping agencies. And so I hope that we can think very clearly. I hope that we can make good, solid, evidence-based decisions about how to reform the police, how to transform the police, whatever the right terminology is. Whatever decisions we make, I just hope we make them calmly. I hope we make them rationally, and I hope we make them based on research evidence. And especially, I hope we just think through the notion of unintended consequences. I think there's a possibility here that we could very quickly, very passionately put in place some reforms that actually make things worse. And I'm just hoping we don't do that.
I think that's a great note to end on. I mean, we all recognize that our brothers and sisters, people who are members of our community, are suffering and are in pain, and we need to take steps to alleviate that pain and suffering. And at the same time, we need to do it in a way that's productive and doesn't make things worse. I really want to thank you for your time. Your insights are very, very valuable. I'm going to put a link, if you could send me the book that you said was of it, could you send me a link to yes. that? That way anyone who's listening to this can read through that. I'll also put your bio and your info up there. And again, thank you so much. I hope maybe down the road I can have another conversation with you and check
anytime.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and say goodbye. Thanks.
Thank you.